Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, a local COVID-19 equity project is getting praise statewide. And later, the new president of Fresno State shares his vision for the future. But first, last year's wildfires decimated hundreds of square miles in the Sierra Nevada. Only now are we learning just how destructive the fires were to an iconic species. The National Park Service just completed a study that estimates 10 to 14% of the state's mature giant sequoias were destroyed in a single wildfire. Our colleague at CAP Radio, Mike Haggerty, tells us more.
The trees were wiped out by the Castle Fire, which burned 273 square miles of tall timber in Sequoia National Park, which sits on the western slopes of the Sierra Nevada and is named after the tree, a redwood. They can grow to 200 feet tall and live for more than 2,000 years. Christy Brigham is the Chief of Resources Management and Science at the park and conducted the study. It showed between 7,500 and 10,000 mature giant sequoias were lost in that one blaze, and Brigham says she was shocked by the numbers.
Surprised and devastated, honestly, Mike. It's really upsetting.
Brigham says many of these trees had survived dozens, if not hundreds, of wildfires in their lifetimes. As she puts it, they're not weaklings. But, she says, a combination of climate change and fire suppression techniques that were popular in the 20th century have created a recipe for the perfect firestorm. And the loss of this many sequoias will only make the environmental situation worse.
These trees are very large. They sequester a lot of carbon. So I think we will see a loss on that front as well.
The groves also provide critical habitat for native wildlife and help protect the watershed that supplies farms and communities on the San Joaquin Valley floor. In Sacramento, I'm Mike Haggerty.
In other environmental news, a conservation group is planting more than 30,000 milkweed plants throughout California, including here in the valley, in the hope of giving western monarch butterflies new places to breed.
The western monarch population is experiencing a pretty rapid decline.
Claire Pavelka is a restoration biologist working with the group River Partners in the San Joaquin Valley. She says milkweed plants are critical because the orange and black butterflies lay their eggs on them.
It grows along rivers a lot of times, but that's also where a lot of agriculture and housing development takes place, so it's a little difficult sometimes to protect that habitat.
She says an annual count recorded fewer than 2,000 of the butterflies. That's about a 99% decline since the 1980s, when there were an estimated 4.5 million butterflies. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last summer, a group of organizations in the Valley came together to combat inequities highlighted by COVID-19. At the core of their work is building community trust, and how they did it is now being adopted in other parts of the state. For this story, FM89's Carrie Klein begins in Monterey County.
Mi nombre es Rosa Chavez.
Rosa Chavez introduces herself in a promotional video designed to inspire people to get the COVID vaccine. She's a farm worker in Greenfield, near Big Sur, and on this day, she's getting her vaccine at a rural clinic. She's doing it, she says, to protect her kids from COVID. It doesn't hurt, she says, and she's happy she did it. The video highlights a Monterey County program known as VIDA, which aims to reach people like Chavez. How do they do that? By training lay people to bring health education and outreach into the communities where they live. Joel Hernandez Laguna is with the Community Foundation for Monterey County. Together with the county, he says they trained more than 100 of these community health workers, not just to run vaccine and testing clinics, but to canvass neighborhoods and speak at food distribution sites.
So what is COVID-19? How is it spread? Educating our community about those different symptoms. You know, if you feel that you need to isolate, how do you do that properly?
Since the program started, the county says they've seen COVID positivity rates improve in the communities they targeted. VITA launched in January, and its inspiration didn't come from the state or San Francisco or LA, but Fresno County. Krista Haney is a program manager with the Monterey County Health Department.
We were intrigued by Fresno having a very innovative approach and wanted to look at how we could replicate aspects of that. We thought what they were doing would work well in Monterey County.
What Fresno is doing is called the COVID-19 Equity Project. It's a collaboration between more than a dozen organizations, as well as UCSF Fresno, the city, and the county.
Mm-hmm. This talks about any possible side effects that you might get with the vaccine.
One of its programs is on Fulton Street in downtown Fresno. The old Goodwill building, with its green marble facade, is now a vaccine clinic a few days a week. Okay.
And then if you want to get in touch with Pfizer, you can contact them by calling this toll-free number.
Thanks to an infusion of more than $12 million from the CARES Act, the collaboration targets disadvantaged neighborhoods, rural areas, and people of color or with disabilities. Patrice Pritchett is the coordinator of this particular clinic, which is hosted by one arm of the Equity Project known as the African American Coalition.
This t-shirt that I have on says, I got my COVID vaccination. And then the other one says, Black and vaccinated.
The overwhelming majority of people vaccinated by the Equity Project are people of color. Fresno also has the highest vaccination rate of any Valley county, and it's come the furthest toward vaccinating its most disadvantaged census tracts. Pritchett says none of that could have happened without community health workers behind the scenes.
We all play a big part in this, from Mr. Russo greeting you at the door to Ms. Michaelin giving you your information in regards of what you're receiving, all the way down to the people setting up the tents and pulling out the chairs.
Beginning last year, Equity Project leaders recruited and trained more than 100 of these workers and secured city and county contracts to get them paid as trusted messengers.
Even if you're scared, if you see somebody else that looks like you and you're saying, man, well, if they can do it, then, you know, maybe I should try. And I believe that that is what's happening for our community to be vaccinated.
Now, Fresno's coalition is recognized as a role model statewide, especially for the curriculum Fresno State developed to train health workers. That's what Monterey County adopted, and so did Santa Cruz County. A similar coalition is developing in Sacramento County, where Kai-Ying Hang works with the grant-giving nonprofit Sierra Health Foundation. She says it's no surprise that such innovation originated right here in the Valley.
There are incredible community leaders and advocates who are tackling these inequities, right? And that they are addressing these challenges head on.
The COVID-19 Equity Project didn't materialize overnight. Organizers first met last April, and it took until August to secure their first round of funding. But Tanya Pacheco-Werner, a health policy director at Fresno State and one of the collaboration's co-leaders, hopes that doesn't discourage others from trying.
I hope that people can see how community members can be experts in their own healthcare. Even with people having a high school education or less than high school education, and it just takes the time and training.
Training that Pacheco-Werner asserts can be used with other community health issues long after COVID is behind us. Fresno's workers hail from all walks of life. Students, grocers, retirees, auto mechanics. Patrice Pritchett used to be a daycare teacher. But she said this job and the gratitude that community members share with her have changed her life.
We're all in the same shoes. We all have the same questions. We all have the same fear. And so now we've created a family in it.
It's a calling she hopes to stay with, even after the pandemic is over. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You just heard Carrie Klein report on a Fresno County coalition that's placed community health workers at the center of its fight against COVID-19. Now Carrie's here to delve more into the idea of equity and how equitable the local COVID response has been as part of our weekly COVID update. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
As usual, let's begin with a Valley-wide status report.
Well, Kathleen, we are looking so good here in the Valley. You know, our case rates and our death rates are down to the lowest they've been in over a year. And in fact, three counties in our area reported no new deaths in the last week. That's Kings, Tulare, and Mariposa counties, which is really exciting. And hospitalization rates continue to drop slowly as well. Almost 2 million vaccine doses have been administered at this point in our region. About 30% of Valley residents have now been fully vaccinated and another 8% partially vaccinated. And then when it comes to business reopenings, we are so close to the finish line, counting down the final days until June 15th, when Governor Newsom is set to lift almost all restrictions on businesses and places of worship. Until then, all counties in the area are in the orange tier, except for Mariposa, which is in the yellow tier. And that's the least restrictive tier of the reopening blueprint.
It is so good to get good news.
I know.
So a lot of your reporting focused on the concept of equity. What does equity mean in the context of the COVID response?
Well, it reflects the idea that some communities are more susceptible to the virus than others. And equity would mean targeting, you know, prevention efforts at those communities specifically and not just at the population at large. And so starting last summer, the state made a commitment to equity, meaning that it would be measuring each county's progress toward fighting the virus, not just for its entire population, but also for its populations considered to be the most disadvantaged. Now, there are, of course, lots of ways to define being disadvantaged, but the state determined this by using something called the Healthy Places Index. It evaluates every census tract in the state based on things that can shape health, like access to healthcare and transportation, safe air and drinking water, access to parks. And so based on these criteria, each census tract gets assigned a score of 1 to 4, and the lowest quartile, those assigned a 1, are considered the most disadvantaged census tracts in the state. And so since last summer, the state has set benchmarks in that lowest quartile for things like testing levels, positivity rates, case rates, and now vaccination rates as a way of ensuring that counties are looking out for the most disadvantaged residents. And that's because those populations are likely also the residents most vulnerable to the health impacts of COVID-19, as well as the indirect effects like financial losses, unemployment, and eviction. And so for some context, I spoke about this with Dr. Venice Curry. She's a physician who was brought on as a consultant for the African American Coalition arm of Fresno's COVID-19 Equity Project. And she says that in a society, every group is connected. So when it comes to health, giving one group a leg up inevitably helps others.
So our focus on the African American community and making sure that people have good information and good access is a service to the whole city and to the whole state. So there aren't any losers in this work.
What do we know at this point for which groups specifically are most at risk of contracting and falling ill from COVID?
Well, we know actually quite a lot about the answer to that question. You know, there are lists of health conditions that make people vulnerable to the virus. We know that essential workers are more susceptible because they've been working in person for much of the last year. Crowded living environments make folks more susceptible. Also, you know, income levels and access to health insurance are tied to virus susceptibility. And so a lot of these factors, which are referred to as the social determinants of health, they converge to put communities of color particularly at risk. And so the state of California makes some ethnic and racial data available. And sure enough, Blacks, Latinos, Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders, and Native Americans have contracted an outsized share of cases. And when it comes to who's dying of COVID, Blacks bear the greatest burden compared to their population levels, while Latinos and in some areas whites have slightly elevated death rates compared to their population sizes.
So does it look like this COVID-19 equity project is having an impact in Fresno County?
The vaccine data suggests that it is. You know, so far, between all of the collaborations, mobile and stationary vaccine clinics, the Equity Project has administered more than 33,000 vaccines. Now, that's pretty small compared to the 700,000 total doses administered throughout the county. But for those 33,000, almost 3/4 of those who receive them identify as people of color. And so that shows the project is reaching a lot of the communities that they're aiming for. Countywide, nearly half of all residents who live in that lowest quartile that I mentioned in those census tracts, almost half of all those residents have been vaccinated. And that's the highest share of all Valley counties. In a recent media call, Fresno County's interim health officer, Dr. Ray Svora, talked about the Equity Project, which is a partner with UCSF Fresno, and he said the collaboration absolutely has had a positive impact on the county's pandemic response.
You know, I think it would have looked much different. I think that we would have had to work a lot harder if it wasn't for UCSF Fresno stepping in and taking on a lot of the burden for doing a lot of that equity work.
As for what this work actually looks like at a person-to-person level, Dr. Venice Curry explained this in terms of customer service, that the community health workers at the core of the Equity Project are trained to respect and elevate the communities they work with. And community members can feel that, and they thank her for it.
What you hear is people saying how pleasant the experience was, how pleasant the people were, how it was an unexpected pleasure to actually go and get service in a way that respected them. That counts for so much, goes a long way, and it's really because of the training, but also just the people that are community health workers. They're just exceptional, and they just show up and do their work with commitment every day.
Whenever the pandemic is over, or at least it's no longer so urgent, what will happen to the COVID Equity Project?
Well, one of the selling points of the collaboration was that this model, you know, leveraging trusted messengers at the ground level, you know, that this could be used to address other community health issues later on down the line. That's what the project's leaders hope for. And Dr. Ray Svora at the county said as much as well.
It's really been an investment that's really paid a lot of dividends through the COVID era. And not that COVID is over, but I think that as we start to expand out and think about other public health issues that we need to address, we'll certainly look at that model to say, you know, how can we create an equity project that looks at, you know, various other diseases that we need to tackle here in Fresno County?
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for this fantastic reporting.
Thank you, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. More than two decades after coming to Fresno State to teach Spanish and Portuguese, Saul Jimenez Sandoval was recently named the 9th president to lead the university. Since last fall, he has been serving as the interim president. I spoke with him about his vision for Fresno State, his approach to closing achievement gaps, and when fans can expect to return to Bulldog Stadium. Your personal background is something that I think is reflective of many Fresno State students. Can you talk about how that might inform your approach to leadership?
Thank you, Kathleen, for this opportunity. Yeah, my background is the background of the region, really, not just of our students. I came here when I was about to be 10. I went through the Fowler school system. I graduated from Fowler High with honors, and then I went off to UC Irvine to find myself, really. While there, I realized what a special community Fresno was, and I came back with a PhD, and I started teaching here Spanish and Portuguese. And throughout that time, I really began to see the incredible diversity and the incredible strengths of our community throughout the time that I was teaching through our students. So it's a story, I think, that's familiar to a lot, because a lot of, you know, have also gone through that as well.
So I would imagine that during your interview process, there was a fair amount of conversation about your vision for Fresno State and your priorities for the university. What are they?
So my vision really is to elevate the visibility and the scope and the positive influence that education, higher education has in the region, Fresno State has in the region. I want people to become aware that every single facet of Fresno life and of the region as a whole, not just of Fresno, but of the entire region, is truly permeated by the power of education that Fresno State represents, and that we literally transform the lives of individuals day in and day out, of regular people who come to us and say, I want to get an education. They get an education, they graduate, and then they become incredible professionals in our communities. I think I want to call attention to key areas that the university produces, you know, this incredible amount of professionals. Key areas would be education, 60% of all of our education administrators have a degree from Fresno State. So that includes principals and superintendents and assistant superintendents, et cetera. The other area would be agriculture. We're an incredible powerhouse in agriculture, engineering, the health sciences. I mean, you know, I can go on and on and on about that, but I really want to make our community aware of how it is that Fresno State really is that shining beacon of light that illuminates just basically every single facet of our lives. And I also want to focus on graduate education. I think for the most part, we think of Fresno State as an undergraduate university. Of course, we're very proud of that, but the graduate degrees are really the shining crowning glory of Fresno State as well. We have incredible degrees in public health, and we have incredible degrees in education, in physical therapy, in nursing. You know, these are the degrees that really sustain so many pillars of our community and in our valley as well.
So in your announcement, you talked about your experience as interim president and how it opened your eyes to the impact of Fresno State on the region. I'm wondering if you could elaborate more. What exactly did you learn about Fresno State's relationship to the community in your role as interim president?
I learned just so much about Fresno State, you know, being interim president. As provost, I got to know the university quite well through our discipline. So I visited every single department we have at Fresno State during my time as provost. And that really gave me a strong, you know, solid background on the type of research we were doing at the university and how the research was impacting our communities, whether it be in health or whether it be in education or the arts as well. You know, we're leaders in all of that. But more than anything, I got to see the big picture of the impact that Fresno State has in the greater community with athletics, for example. Athletics is this incredible synergy at Fresno State that literally brings our community together. You know, our community cheers on our team. And in doing so, what happens is that we become one single community, one single big red wave, right, cheering on our Bulldog teams. The power of athletics is one that is like no other. So I got to see that very valuable part of it. I also got to see how industry plays an incredible part in our educational journey as well. Fresno State is an incredible university because we connect students to the world. We literally connect students to a future of promise and a future of, you know, stability as well. And, you know, a thriving stability for that matter. But along that line, though, I began to see how Fresno State is this just incredible energy that it has the power to innovate with our industry partners, with this experiential learning that we're developing, you know, in a great scale right now. I want to make the public aware that at Fresno State, we give back to the community 1 million hours of volunteer work each and every year. And this volunteer work includes our internships, and it also includes our service learning classes as well. So 1 million hours makes us the clear leader across the country, not just within California, but across the country, as far as what we give back to the community. And those 1 million hours, of course, can be directly connected to our industry partners who can provide our students with this experience that they need in order to connect the theoretical that they have in the mind with the actual practice doing it in the workplace. So I'm looking forward to strengthening that relationship with our industry partners. I'm looking forward to also promoting a sense of economic growth and innovation within Fresno State that impacts our region as well. I think that's going to be very crucial. I want to collaborate with K-12 and also our community colleges so that we all collectively together promote a college-going culture, because the more college degrees we have in our community, the more innovative we become, the more economically stable we are, the more startups there will be in our region. So I see Fresno State as a direct partner to the economic stability and the economic future of the Fresno region.
So you talked about athletics. Any updates on opening Bulldog Stadium to fans in the fall?
Sure. We will have fans in the fall, for sure. That's a given. We are still waiting for guidelines as to what that will look like, to what degree we'll be able to fill up our stadium. But I'm very confident that we'll be able to have fans in the fall, and that we'll be able to really come together again and cheer for our teams.
Well, let's talk about academics in the fall as well. What is it going to look like?
It'll look like 70 and 75% will be face-to-face, which is a great change for us. We were in fall 2020, just a year ago, 7% face-to-face. And then this last spring, 2021, we were at 11% face-to-face. So from that 11% face-to-face, we're going to scale it up to about 75% face-to-face. The rest of it will be the traditional classes that we've always had. We have never been 100% face-to-face. We've always had a pretty strong component of online courses, but the rest of that will be also virtual synchronous, and then asynchronous as well. And then we also have these classes that are not fully face-to-face, but interface with the community very strongly, such as nursing, for example, is one of those classes as well. So we'll bring back the students to the campus. We'll open up the library. We'll open up the spaces for our students to be on campus and to really enjoy the experience of being students at Fresno State. One of the biggest lessons we learned is that the students miss the university. Of course, they miss the university. And of course, they miss their classes. But what they really missed the most was the space, the ability to go to the library and say, I'm going to take, you know, an hour of my time to just really focus on what I have to focus, to really write that essay and just be in a silent space in which I can do my work. Or I'm going to go to, you know, the student center and then just really meet with friends, interact with friends, and just, you know, relieve that stress of the everyday. The mental health issue, it's big with our students right now, because we need to bring back the experience of a university more than anything.
So within education in general, there is a lot of talk about closing achievement gaps, meaning specifically, how do you create conditions where Black and Brown students are graduating at similar rates as their white counterparts? And while this is a problem across academia, it's certainly not unique to Fresno State, it is one that needs to be addressed sort of campus by campus, even classroom by classroom. So what is your approach to improving educational outcomes for historically underrepresented students?
We have equity gaps at Fresno State. We have about a 10% equity gap between Pell Grant recipients and non-Pell Grant recipients. And Pell Grant recipients, for the most part, tend to come from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. And that's really the one area that I'm going to go after more than any other area. And we have courses at Fresno State that have traditionally been too challenging for our students and that have discouraged our students at the beginning of their career. I think what we need to understand with that is that the critical years for someone who comes to college, for a college student, are the beginning years. It's the beginning years when this individual begins to get acclimated, you know, to what Fresno State is about, begins to think about the future, begins to think about what they want to become as a professional when they graduate from Fresno State. So it's the freshman and sophomore years that are critical to me. Within the freshman and sophomore years, then what we have are begin to say this triad of very challenging classes that tend to stump our students. And these are the typical ones that anyone, you know, would guess. It's mathematics with calculus, it's chemistry, and it is writing. These three classes are fundamental to our students. Yet year after year after year, we see that when our students do not successfully pass these classes, they either drop out or their graduation rate, you know, goes very, very much into the future. I'll give you just a brief example. If a student takes a class in a writing class at Fresno State, and every single freshman has to take writing at Fresno State, and gets an F in that class, they will only have a 12% chance of graduating in 6 years. So what are we doing about that? We are scaling up our resources as far as tutoring is concerned, as far as advising is concerned with our students as well. We are trying to really make our students aware that writing is not a process that is an assignment, but is more than anything, it is a journey of discovery. It's a journey of self-discovery, because when somebody writes, only that one individual will be able to write that one unique sentence. No one in the world can write the sentences like you can, or like I can, or like anybody else can. So we're trying to really focus on the power of writing as akin to the power of an identity, of knowing yourself, of developing yourself in the world, interpreting the world, and then finding yourself in the world so that you can become a leader in our community. So that's the type of strategies that we're using in order to close the equity gap and in order to close these failing grades in the writing classes. We're doing the same thing with chemistry, and we're going to do the same thing as well with calculus.
Before we wrap up, I do want to talk about this sort of unique situation that you're in that your chancellor is, of course, Fresno State's former president, Joseph Castro, someone who not only understands the job that you've been tasked with, but with whom you have a close working relationship. So to that end, I'm just curious, given the enormity of the responsibilities that fall on a university president's shoulders, did you get any advice about how to navigate the stress and how to maintain a healthy work-life balance?
Sure, yeah. Chancellor Castro, it's a wealth of advice, and he's a wealth of information as well. He has incredible insight. He's a visionary, and I truly admire him for all he's done for our valley and all he's doing for California as well. And you know, the most valuable advice that the chancellor gave me was be true to your values. And my values right now are to further our student success, because every time our students are successful at Fresno State, we then make the community better for everyone. We elevate the quality of life for everyone in the valley. So part of my values, of course, are also my family. It's Mariana and, you know, my two sons, Arion and Leo. And then of course, my extended family. I don't know if the listeners know this, but I'm the 8 of 8. So I'm the youngest of 8 children. I have 5 sisters and 2 brothers, and my father still lives in Fowler. So part of the work-life balance also goes to, you know, giving them some time, keeping up with what it is that is happening with my 15-year-old and my 13-year-old, and making sure that we're all fine at home. I think the home is the basis for everything. And then from there, you know, I grow into really working for our community through Fresno State.
Well, I've been talking with Fresno State President Saul Jimenez Sandoval. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your new role.
It's been an honor, and I love KVPR, and I love your show as well, Kathleen. I thank you for all you do as well for all of us.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The Kings County city of Corcoran is slowly but steadily sinking, as much as 11.5 feet in some places over the last 14 years. Lois Henry, a journalist with SJV Water, recently wrote about it for the New York Times. I spoke with her about how agriculture and its reliance on groundwater is to blame. So to start, can you give us a sense of scope here? How much is the land in Corcoran and in the surrounding area sinking? And how fast is it projected to sink in the future?
Well, that's the second part of that question is really hard to do to answer. But the first part is that it has been sinking at times up to 2 feet a year. Sometimes that rate can go down into the, you know, few inches a year, but it's always sinking. The difference in rate is determined really on the need for groundwater by farmers, because if it's a dry year like this year, they're going to be pumping a lot more water. They only got 5% of their allocation from the state. So, you know, and the rivers coming down through the valley are all but dry, and there's just nothing left up in the mountains. So they're going to be turning to groundwater. So you can bet this year that we're going to see, you know, a lot of sinking. How much? It's just it all depends on how much people are going to be pumping. So there's just no way to say, you know, in 5 years Corcoran will be at X elevation, because each year is different.
Absolutely. And I do want to talk more about this summer and the drought in a minute. But before we go there, I want to focus on the actual impact that this sinkage has on the people who live in Corcoran, both in terms of the infrastructure and in terms of financial cost.
Well, that is a really interesting thing. I thought when I started this story that I would hear from a lot of outraged residents, because one of the most tangible, in their face, you know, cost directly to residents out of their pocketbook was in 2017, when we actually had a big water year. There's a levee around Corcoran that protects it because it's on the edge of the old Tulare Lake bed. And when we have a big water year, the rivers that fed that lake years and years and years ago can still come back and they can still swamp the town. So that levee is important to protect Corcoran. And in 2017, the levee district had discovered that it had sunk to the point that it was going to potentially not protect the town and, you know, break and have breaches. So they had to fix it, and they had to fix it quickly. And so they had to get the residents of Corcoran to authorize a tax. So they taxed themselves $10 million to fix this thing in 2017, which meant $200 to $300 a year for 3 years on people's property taxes. I don't know if listeners feel like that's a large amount of money, but in a town where the median income is $40,000 a year, that's a lot of money. So when I went about this story and I was talking to people about it, they kind of remembered that this had happened, and then, yeah, we'd seen it on our taxes, you know, but we really think that was the city just trying to get some money, and, you know, we never saw flooding. And so they kind of like related it to flooding and not to the fact that it had sunk. Literally the ground had fallen out from beneath it because of groundwater pumping. It had sunk and they had to repair it. So they just didn't make that connection. I mean, subsidence is a strange thing, you know, especially if it's not breaking water mains and cracking the foundations of your house and your driveways at different levels, you know, and that's not happening in Corcoran. So they're not seeing that on a regular basis and hearing about it, because the area around Corcoran that's sinking, that, and Corcoran is the center of this, it's known as the Corcoran Bowl. It can be as large as 60 miles in some years. So when you have that vast of an area sinking, it's like it's all deflating at the same time, you know? So you're not seeing, you know, one side of the street going down and the other side staying up. And that's when you're going to see, you know, massive damage to roads and bridges and water mains and all that kind of stuff. So when I talked to the public works director there, Joe Faulkner, he even said, yeah, it's a little strange because we've been sinking sometimes 2 feet in a year and we haven't seen the kind of damage that you would think that we would see, you know, other than the levee, obviously, and they've had a couple of drinking water wells that the casings, you know, down below were crushed because the land sank in on them. And so they had to fix those, but that wasn't a direct cost to each citizen. You know, they obviously have funds within the water supply system, and they use those funds to fix those wells at $600,000. So they just haven't seen, you know, it's just this strange kind of ghost hanging over the town. And most folks who are working and going about their business and stuff, they haven't like really computed it and what it means to the future of the town. Now, when you talk to the leaders of the town, they all do know that subsidence is happening, but they're just convinced that Corcoran has a very bright future. And they're very committed to the town, and they're, in fact, the residents, you know, passed a sales tax, a 1 cent sales tax in 2017, and they're talking about using that money for a lot of amenities to try and attract growth. So it was interesting, to say the least, to talk to folks about this.
You know, it was one of the things that I found really surprising in your reporting. You know, it's easy to understand that people wouldn't be particularly upset if it's happening so slowly that they don't really notice. But the other thing that you pointed to in your article is that there seems to be a reluctance on the part of city leaders in particular to be critical of ag because the economy is so deeply dependent upon it.
Yeah, that's, you know, I mean, it's such a strange situation where the ag is providing the jobs and the tax base for Corcoran, no doubt. I mean, yes, there are prisons there, but the prisons, you know, they pay a high wage to their to the employees, but those employees mostly live elsewhere. So they're not buying homes and buying groceries and buying gas and paying, you know, sales tax in Corcoran. So really it's ag. And then you have ag having to pump all of this water to stay in business to continue to provide these jobs. So it's just this really hand in glove kind of, I guess we're all going down together. You know, it's a really interesting conundrum. Now, of course, on top of that, there's the issue of sales of surface water out of the area, which, you know, was a separate kind of a situation that I got into.
Yeah, you read my mind. That's exactly where I was headed next. So talk to me about the J.G. Boswell company and how much of the blame is being directed at that one particular company.
Well, I would hesitate to ever say that you can blame any one company, because as you'll notice in the article, I went out and I looked at the various different large agricultural operations, and there are a multitude.
All of which are engaging in pumping to some extent, correct?
Right, exactly. They're all having to pump groundwater. So they're all, you know, a part of this issue. But you start to look at each individual company and what they're putting in the ground. And Boswell stands out clearly because the Boswell company owns like 100,000 acres in the area. You know, not a lot of people coming close to that. And when I went to the records, and we could talk about how terrible a job the state does in keeping well records, which is interesting because they're, you know, forcing all of these farmers to do all this groundwater management. And yet the record keeping for wells was just horrendous. But through that and through the county, I pieced together enough public records to show that even if all things are equal, you know, J.G. Boswell has more than double the number of wells that even the largest next farmer does in comparison. And then, you know, from that guy on down, it's just, you know, it's like, it's just fractions, right? So clearly Boswell has the most wells and the largest and the deepest. And when I started looking at these well completion reports, they do, once you start learning how to read them, it's just eye-opening. I mean, since 2010, Boswell has put in like just dozens and dozens and dozens of new wells and put them into this, to the depth of 2,400 feet. And they are so large, they can pump up to 4,400 gallons per minute. That is enough to fill your average swimming pool in 5 minutes. I mean, that's how much water we're talking about here. So you can't pin the blame on Boswell. You cannot do that. But they are pumping a lot of water out from under Corcoran, a lot. And they're right around, their well fields are all right around Corcoran. So, you know, I just leave that where it is. I don't pin blame. I just say these are the facts.
Sure. But then there has been the criticism about the Boswell company selling surface water while they're pumping.
Yeah, that is how I got on this story. I had, you know, other farmers in that area called me and asked me to come out and take a look. I mean, this started, you know, June of 2020 during the pandemic. They called and asked me to come out and look at this. Because there were the Boswell wells were just running this massive amounts of water into these ditches. And if you followed it along, it would go to this retaining cell. And, you know, I don't know anything about farming. I was like, well, okay, so, you know, there's this water and it's going to this retaining cell, and what, they're going to irrigate with it? And they were saying, yes, that's correct. But they're only doing this because they're selling off so much surface water. They're having to do this with groundwater. And in the era of trying to, you know, meet state mandates about groundwater management and sustainability, the other farmers were angry and shocked and just felt that this was not the right way to go about things. And so I was interested, okay, so he's irrigating with groundwater and he's selling off surface water. Who's going to be really interested in that? And then they all sort of went, well, yeah, and Corcoran's sinking. And okay. You know, maybe that's something to look at. What do you mean it's sinking? You know, and then I looked up the groundwater plan, you know, because the state is requiring that they come up with these plans to try and mitigate the groundwater pumping. And in that plan, I mean, it's written in that plan. I was kind of like, oh, come on, guys. You know, these farmers would tell me stuff and I would think, yeah, come on, you know, you're just exaggerating. in that plan, it shows, yeah, we're going to sink Corcoran from, you know, another 6 to 11 feet from where we are today.
It's in the plan.
It's in the plan. It's in the plan. Is that a good plan? I don't know. I can't tell, but I just don't think it would pass muster with the state, which is saying you got to get your groundwater house in order specifically to stop subsidence. I mean, that's one of the specific things that they say you must stop subsidence. So anyway, so there was that. And then I looked up some of they put together annual reports, you know, how are you doing towards your goal? And in one of those annual reports, it was like, oh God, you know, it was even worse. The trajectory of Corcoran was headed to the 11, you know, the 6 to 11 feet was like, oh, there's this range and we're going to try and stay to 6 feet, but you know, it could get to 11 feet. Oh, it's headed to 11 feet already. You know, so I, you know, all of that combined made me just sort of think this is crazy. You know, this is just crazy.
So we've been talking around the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Tell us briefly what that is and give us a sense of what impact it could have, if any, on pumping this summer, particularly given that we are in a severe drought.
SGMA, which is the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, was passed in 2014, went into effect in 15, and doesn't really have an enforcement date until 2040. So different groundwater agencies, which were established under the law, are handling things in very, very different ways. Some groundwater agencies in the Valley have already started curtailing how much their landowners can pump. They have started charging fees for how much you can pump if you go over your allotment. They have started buying water and bringing it into their area for more recharge. And other areas, like the area around Corcoran, where there's a groundwater agency there, mostly covers Boswell's lands and happens to be run by a majority on the board of Boswell employees. If you look at their plan, they don't have any curtailments that they're going to be doing. And I couldn't find any fees being charged if you go over any amount. And I didn't find any real plans to bring in water to try and mitigate the loss from groundwater pumping. So in fact, their plan gets to 2035 and, you know, just sort of business as usual. And then in 2035, somehow magically everything kind of bounces back. Water tables come up, subsidence stops, et cetera, without any real like, you know, well, how are you going to get there? So I imagine in that area that pumping this summer will continue at the rate that it has in the past. And this will just cause the area to sink even further, as opposed to some other areas that are trying to do curtailments, like I said. So you might not see as much of a subsidence or dropping of the groundwater table. But like I said, the state and federal governments are curtailing the amount of water coming in from the projects that bring water into the valley from the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta. So just naturally, there's going to be a lot more pumping.
Makes sense. Well, I have been talking with SJV Waters' Lois Henry. Her article, The Central California Town That Keeps Sinking, was published in the New York Times last week. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
And finally, for our series looking at how people are processing their experiences around the pandemic, we hear from Rodia Montgomery Gentry. She's a social science teacher and department chair at Madera South High School. As schools start to reopen, Montgomery Gentry reflects on the challenges of connecting to students through online learning. FM89's news director Alice Daniel produced this audio postcard.
Not seeing them it's made it so difficult for me. I'm constantly pushing myself to do more, giving them pizza for student of the month, having that sent home to them. Anything, just you go beyond what you normally would have done had you been here. Students help me when I can pair them up to help each other. I know how to match students to bring out the best in them. I couldn't do that. breakout rooms and talking to them one-on-one always helped, because I got it, you could one, see their face, and you've seen who you were talking to. The second part is they seemed to relax when I said, you know, you would not be this, you would not have this grade if I seen you in class. That I know that this has affected you because you're in this COVID thing. This is not you, and your grades don't reflect you. This is just a reflection of where you're at, what you're put through, but this is not you. And that you just see them relax, and then you'd try to find out, what do you like? I like skateboarding, and I would make my little notes. And so then when I went into talking to others, I would say, oh, did you go skateboarding, or did you build, I remember one student, he built a pergola, and I would say, did you build another one? Or just my little comments helped me to get to know them a little bit more, and I think they felt, thank you for remembering, or validated. And those things are hard to do on this online, to develop relationships, which they so need. I think that was hard. They can't have that connection, that connection between their peers and connection between us, and that was lacking. And I thought of something. In prison, how do you make, what's punishment in prison? And it's solitary confinement. And that's what I feel that they've been through, is solitary confinement. And that's hard. It's hard to see that solitary confinement. That's been the hard part. So to try to get them out of it is joking or talking or something. That part's been hard.
The music for this piece was composed and played by Benjamin Boone. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.